The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 4 of this 7-day sesshin in January 2017 here at Hidden Valley Zen Center on a beautiful day in Southern California. Chilly, but of course it's winter. And I'd like to speak today on the subject of chanting. Chanting is a major part of Buddhist practice, whether it is Zen or the Tibetan practice, or Son, the Korean, or Chan, the Chinese. And it needs to be perhaps explained a little bit. Why do we chant? Back in the era of the Buddha, there were no written words. Writing had not been established in the part of the world that he lived in, although it had been going on for quite a while in China. China was ahead of the game with a lot of things. But in northern India, they had no written language. And as is true still in many parts of the world, the history, the cultural memory was taken care of through chant, through voice. There's a tradition of troubadours in many countries, including countries in Western Europe. Not so much in the United States, but perhaps that's because everything was so far flung. But in Europe, in Eastern Europe, in some parts of Central Europe, the tradition still holds. And there are minstrels that go from village to village, town to town, singing the history of the area. So it was during the Buddha's time, and after the Buddha died, his disciple and an attendant, who also happened to be his cousin, Ananda, who had a photographic memory, was able to repeat verbatim all the teshos, all the talks that the Buddha had given. This sounds like a major thing, but when I was living in Burma in the 1960s, every year in Mandalay, monks gathered from all over the country to recite the sutras by memory. And there were actually contests, people that could recite the most sutras and so on. This is how it usually happened. And in China, in relatively contemporary China, the Zen master Sheng Yen, who was born and raised in mainland China and into a family that was so poor that they had to eat weeds. They couldn't even afford food other than what he could find. As the youngest child, it was his job to go out and find weeds that they could eat. And so he was pretty malnourished as a young man, to the point where it seemed like he was a little bit simple. And his family had finally decided what they would do would be to marry him off to a young girl who was also a little bit mentally deficient, and in the hopes that somehow the two of them could keep life together. And then the priest, who would come sometimes to visit his mom because she was a devout practitioner of Buddhism, in particular a devotee of Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion. He came one day when Sheng Yin was something like 13 years old, about the time they were thinking of marrying him off, and said, "Why don't you instead give him to the monastery?" And so his mother was delighted to do that, and his father agreed, and so off he went to the monastery, where he actually got reasonable food. And in that monastic training, a good part of it was memorizing the sutras. And when Buddhism first came to China, memorizing the sutras, studying the sutras, the teachings of the Buddha, was prominent. It wasn't until Bodhidharma arrived that actual meditation apparently was made known in China as a Buddhist practice. But at any rate, going back to the time of the Buddha after he died, his senior students were anxious to somehow maintain the teachings and pass them along because they were so profound. And the words of the Buddha are these days written down in what are known as sutras. And so there was a council of elders to figure out what to do. Ananda was originally not admitted because it was only those who had awakening experiences who were allowed to be part of that first council. And Ananda was so embarrassed. There he'd been 30 years side by side with the Buddha, hearing every word he said, ample opportunity to practice, and yet he had not yet had a breakthrough. And he was so embarrassed about that he was able to break through and have an awakening experience that qualified him to attend that first council. And he was of prime importance in that council because he was able to recite verbatim everything that he had heard the Buddha say. And this is why the sutras all begin, "Thus have I heard," because this is Ananda repeating what he had heard. They're also pretty classically, except in more modern translations where they've edited some of that out, that traditionally everything is repeated three times in order to sink it more deeply into memory. These are some of the tricks that they had in those days for fixing things that were heard into memory. And the monks learned to chant these because, of course, for a long time, it wasn't until 100 years after the Buddha died that there was any writing available, any method of writing available to put down these things. And so the words were put down in Pali and in Sanskrit, depending on which part of the country they were written down in. Originally, they were written on palm leaves, scratched into palm leaves. And, of course, repeatedly spoken over and over and over again, and that is the origin of our chanting. What we chant are the Buddha's teachings. Now, over time, there has been some addition to those sutras. We chant some of the teachings of masters who came after the Buddha. The harmony of relative and absolute is one chant that is part of that category. As well, a sort of a subset of the chants are what are known as dharanis. Shosaimyoku Jijo Dharani and the Daihishin Dharani, also known as the Daihishu, are both Dharanis. And Dharanis came out of India as expressions of sound intended in a particular direction. And so they are not translated normally. Now, they did get translated into Chinese characters. I should say written down. The sounds got written down as Chinese characters. When these dharanis went from India to China, But that's only because they had to have some way of noting what the sounds were. Eventually, D.T. Suzuki in Japan translated the Daihishi Nirani, and it sort of makes some sense, but not particularly as a deep teaching. It really is meant to be heard as sound. And sound is extremely powerful. Back in the 1960s, there was a French doctor who was an otolaryngologist, in other words, an ear, nose, and throat doctor. And he also, some say, was also a psychologist. He happened to have been born into a family of opera stars, so he heard music from the get-go. And his life was filled with music. And he chose to use sound as an avenue for exploration and became quite an expert in sound. And in 1967, he was called to a French Benedictine monastery because the monks had suffering some kind of malaise. It wasn't clear what was going on. They'd already seen a number of different doctors who couldn't pinpoint what was happening. But these monks had taken a vow of silence, except for their 6 to 8 hours of chanting every day, had fallen into a kind of torpor, a real malaise. And they had lost interest in everything and something was dreadfully wrong. So he was finally called in as an expert, and what had happened was shortly before that, the Vatican had issued an encyclical, and in which they did a number of things. It may have been then that they allowed the Mass to be told in the vernacular as opposed to in Latin, and they gave a certain amount of freedom to abbots to change the schedule of their monasteries. And so that particular Benedictine monastery, which had just gotten a new abbot, eager to get things really rolling, he decided to eliminate the chanting. There were 6 to 8 hours of chanting every day. And these monks also, they did a lot of hard labor, and they did not sleep very much, something like 4 hours a night. But when the chanting was eliminated, in order to, as far as the abbot was concerned, let them rest a little bit more, and also make their day a little bit more efficient, they could do more work and also get more rest if they eliminated the chanting. And that's when things started going downhill. And the good doctor, Alfred Tomatis, determined that the problem was that these monks who did not speak because they had taken a vow of silence, and you recall during our session, technically we don't speak any more than is absolutely necessary. For the work period, we can get instructions in speech. But in general, there's no chanting. We use that time to dive deeply within and ignore outer concerns unless they are somewhat of an emergency. And the schedule is set up so that we can basically ignore outer concerns. At any rate, Dr. Tomatis felt that these monks were being robbed of a certain essential stimulation in not having that chanting. And so he asked the abbot to reinstate the chanting. And that made all the difference in the world. They went back to their original traditional centuries-old schedule of 6 to 8 hours of chanting, only 4 hours of sleep, And they were able to be so energized by the chanting that they only needed the 4 hours of sleep. Now, Dr. Mattis, or Tomatis, also discovered that there's a very big difference between hearing and listening. How many times have you said to somebody, "Are you listening? Did you really hear what I said?" And they say, "Oh yeah, yeah, I heard what you said." But did they really? Or were they simply listening? There is a big difference, and I'd like to share with you something that was written about this. Tomatis observed that hearing and listening differed markedly from each other. Hearing, he reasoned, was simply the physical ability to passively perceive sound. Listening, however, was an active skill that required the ability to process information by tuning into certain sounds while filtering others out. If an individual lacked the ability to listen, Tomatis noticed, learning was greatly impaired. While researching this phenomenon, Tomatis observed that people who perceive sounds first through the right ear learn much more easily than those who perceive sounds first through the left ear. This was because the right ear connects directly to the left side of the brain, which is the site that processes language. The left ear, on the other hand, connects to the right side of the brain. In order to interpret sounds listening, entering the left ear, the brain must first send them through the corpus callosum, which is a part of the brain, which retards the transfer of information and makes it less reliable. In fact, some of the higher frequencies, which are crucial to the brain's ability to interpret language, disappear altogether. Attention is also involved in this. In our modern day, we really don't pay a whole lot of attention to anything. We multitask, or think we do, which really means skipping back and forth among a number of different things that hold our supposed attention, none of which are actually getting our full attention, and therefore none of which are really being fully experienced. And this comes to another aspect of chanting. To truly chant, we need to really give ourselves to the experience. And in order to give ourselves to the experience, it's strongly advised that in the beginning, we don't read the chant book. We simply listen. We hear the sounds. We take in the sounds. This is particularly important with some of the chants that are not in English. The Prajnaparamita in Japanese, and the Dharanis, and those are the three really that are not done in English in our chanting. And because they're nonsense syllables, and nonsense syllables are notoriously difficult to learn, to memorize. But if we hear them, take them in, it's a very different experience. When I was at Soyinji, in the winter time, I first went there in the fall, and so I was there as it got colder and colder and colder, and there's an hour of chanting. It's absolutely wonderful. A whole hour of chanting, first thing in the morning, beginning at 4 o'clock in the morning at Soyinji in the Hondo, which is this enormous barn-like building. It's about twice as big, at least, of this building here that we're in right now. And it backs up against a mountain. And every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, the cold air rushes down from the mountaintops, seeking the valley, and flows through this drafty, uninsulated building. And the last thing you want to do is be holding your bare hands out in the draft, holding a sutra book. And so the faster you can learn the sutras, the warmer you will be. Chanting also energizes the body and the mind. It's a wonderful way to wake up, and this is why we do it first thing in the morning during Sesshin. So to listen first, to hear first, to experience first, for several weeks running, the sounds, just the sounds, to take them in, to feel them. Dharanis actually are meant to be received in this way anyway. And then if you want to do a little study, then to pick up the sutra book and follow along the English ones, and then to put it back down again, to memorize these sutras, these chants, as quickly as possible, makes it much more effective to receive their teaching. And these are the teachings. Some of them, like the Prajnaparamita, the Heart of Perfect Wisdom, is a direct teaching of the Buddha. It is considered his deepest teaching, actually. Others, there are some that we chant out of respect. The preface to the Record of Rinzai Esho Zenji is meant to inspire. And the Bodhisattva vow of Tore Enji's Bodhisattva vow, is a wonderful teaching in its own right by Tore, who is a deeply realized Dharma heir of the great Zen master Hakuin. And the harmony of relative and absolute is another deep teaching. So these teachings can be absorbed beyond words. When we do our practice, we have to necessarily go beneath the level of words to reach the understanding that is deep enough to liberate us. We cannot think our way to enlightenment. We can take the words of the sutras, particularly the Prajnaparamita, the Heart of Perfect Wisdom. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. It is said that, I think it was Bodhidharma. No, it wasn't Bodhidharma. He said his response was something else. But there was a young child who eventually became a profound and deeply realized Zen master, who was caught by the sutra saying, "No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind." He says, "But I have an eyes. I have two eyes. I have a nose. I have a tongue. I can speak. I have a body. What is this? No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind." Take that into your own questioning. Again, it has to be beyond words. How can it say, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, when here we are living, breathing, eyes, ears, noses, tongues, bodies, and minds? And yet it's a profound teaching. We reach a depth of understanding, it's very clear the meaning of this. So here's an opportunity as you continue chanting. With regard to the Dharanis, and with regard to, for example, we also chant the Prajnaparamita in Japanese. We do that because we still have a very strong connection with Japan and with Japanese Zen. And it's sort of the lingua franca of Japanese Zen. It doesn't matter what lineage, they all chant the Hanya Shingyo. And so people coming in from other temples, other sects, can feel at home. Not to mention, as I said, our very strong connection with Sogenji in Japan and with Harada Roshi. In addition to that, the meaning of these chants does not necessarily depend on whether they are in our own language. As an example of this, I'd like to cite an incident that took place, I think in Southern California actually, probably about 15 years ago. It made the news then. There was a pool party, a great gathering of people around a swimming pool. And all of a sudden, a woman in the midst of the party starts screaming, "My baby, my baby, he's in the water. Help, please, somebody help me." And this young man heard her screaming, saw to his puzzlement that everybody else was looking at her kind of dumbfounded. He understood what she was saying, and he jumped in and he got the baby out, saved its life. Only later did he find out that the reason nobody was able to move on it was because she was screaming in Spanish. And this was a young man who had never been exposed to Spanish. He did not know the language and had not heard it. And yet he understood immediately what the situation was. She was able to communicate to him even though he did not understand the language that she was speaking. And so we don't necessarily have to have the sutras in our own language in order to get the deeper meaning out of them. But this also means that in the chanting, we need to hear, not just to listen. We need to hear. We need to deeply resonate with the sound. We need to lose ourselves completely in the chanting. And I offer you this quote from Kapla Roshi. "Mind is unlimited. Chanting, when performed egolessly, has the power to penetrate visible and invisible worlds." Mind is unlimited. We experience only a very small portion of it. Chanting can open the doorway to a wider experience. So in addition to giving us vital teachings, it also can, if we chant wholeheartedly, losing ourselves in the chant. And this is another reason why it's important simply to memorize the chants and not to keep reading them. When we keep reading them, there's words on the page that get in the way of the deeper comprehension of the meaning of the chants. It can take us very, very deep. It's important. This is why it's endured over all of these centuries. The Buddha lived more than 2,500 years ago, and yet all over the world in Buddhist temples, chanting continues to this day, not just in the Zen sect, but in virtually all the other sects of Buddhism. So I hope this makes a difference to you, and you put it into work, and you will find both that you'll be much more energized through the chanting, and your practice will deepen more readily as a result of it. I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.